Well, now let's go to our feature guest for the morning, the renowned genetic epidemiologist and award-winning author, Professor Tim Spector. Perhaps best known for introducing the world to the wonders of the gut microbiome in his first book, The Diet Myth. In his latest book, called Food for Life, it's an eater's guide to happy gut microbes. And Professor Tim Spector says the gut is like an organ in the body that can be trained to be healthy. He says almost everything we think we know about food is wrong, including calorie counting, the war on carbs, and the idea that there is any such thing as a superfood or a toxic food. He's also co-founder of the nutrition company Zoe, which offers home kits that test gut microbes, blood sugar, blood fats, all to provide a personalised list of recommended foods.
My previous books have told people a bit about the theory behind food and our gut microbes. And this book is a practical guide that everyone's been asking me for. It really goes into the detail of our foods and how you get down to the nitty-gritty of how you actually pick foods in a supermarket at home, what combinations of foods, what's going to be good and bad for you, how to spot a dodgy label in a shop, and also, you know, getting people much more in tune to work out what quality food means and what's bad about ultra-processed foods.
You talk a lot about ultra-processed foods in the guide. Why is it that they have become such a huge part of so many people's diets? And what is it that is so bad about them?
Well, they've gradually been creeping up since the 1970s into our culture. And it's as developed countries and probably mainly the sort of English-speaking countries have led the way, perhaps because of a lack of basic food culture, so that they now, in countries like the UK, the US, Australia, New Zealand, are, you know, around 50% of our energy comes from these ultra-processed foods, and probably about 70% of our children's. And we didn't, you know, they've done a great job in feeding the world cheaply and having products that last a long time on shelves, don't go off, maybe, you know, could possibly reduce food waste. But what they're doing is they're changing our taste buds. They are messing up our gut microbes, and they're making us overeat. And the food industry now is so massive that it lobbies governments across the world to make sure that no one really studies this and no one tells people about this and sends us down on these blind alleys talking about fats and reducing saturated fat and replacing it with something else, or having a slightly lower calorie count and having a healthy sticker on the label, or adding a few useless vitamins and then making sure that product is seen as healthy. So it's a bit of a battle, really, between the food manufacturers and the public, with the governments in between.
What are some of the most egregious examples of things that we've got wrong, areas we've got wrong, and sort of, like you say, these blind alleys that we've ended up going down to the detriment of our health?
Well, there's so many, really. I mean, I think the glaring example that people use is children's yogurts. These are billed as healthy. I've got nothing against products that are obviously unhealthy, like Pepsi Cola, Coca Cola, Fantas, etc. People know they're not good for you. They're sugary and it's transparent. But other things like children's yogurt, which are promoted as being a healthy source of many things for children and might claim to have some added vitamins, just our vehicles for sugar, artificial sweeteners, fake fruits, and giving children a really overly sweet tooth, so they will become customers forever of either sugar or artificial sugar.
But those are the kind of things that many people would reach for in the supermarket because they think they are healthy. They think they are
exactly
buying nutritious food for their kids.
Exactly. And they're doing it in good faith. And I think that's the other thing is breakfast cereals, which in our countries have, cartoons and healthy, fun characters on the front, and it's plastered with vitamin adverts and things of how it's got all these incredible vitamins in it, and it's a sort of health food, and combined with milk, it gives everything you need for your child, and basically it's just giving your children a sugar rush, and with very low quality vitamins that they wouldn't need if they had a decent diet, and many of these aren't effective anyway. So it's my beef is not with ultra processed food per se, as long as it's transparent what it is, but it's this stealth by which they've been introduced into our food system, and the vast majority of the public believe many of the things they're eating are actually perfectly healthy. They also believe they've been tested by governments to make sure they are healthy and safe, and that every time there's a new ingredient, a new artificial sweetener, a new emulsifier or glue to stick it together, they've been properly tested. And of course they haven't. And as soon as independent academics do test some of these things, that it does raise questions. But the lobbying power of the food companies, sends out negative press, and they have, they've got millions and millions to counter any false pre negative press against them.
What sort of effect do these ultra-processed foods have on our microbiome, on our gut? And in turn, what does that do to our body?
So we know from a large number of mouse and rat experiments and l fewer human experiments that the gut microbe is affected by ultra-processed foods in strange ways. So in some ways it's negative because most ultra-processed foods have none or very little fiber. So the body gets a signal that it's getting food, but none of this actually reaches the gut microbes. It's all absorbed very early on. And so you get sugar peaks and fat peaks, but not much fiber reaches the gut microbes, which is in the lower part of our gut in the larger intestine. But the things that do reach the gut microbes are several components of ultra processed food, such as artificial sweeteners, which they're all different, but there's about six on the market at the moment, and they all have slightly different actions. But most of them do affect the gut microbes and will cause them to produce abnormal chemicals. And this has been shown in a number of experiments to these chemicals are actually pro-diabetic and act against your own healthy metabolism. So, we used to think these were completely inert. So things like the saccharins or aspartames, those chemicals, which all have come generally from the petrol industry, but they just by chance happened to be sweet. We thought they were inert. They just passed straight through us, down to the toilet, gave us a nice sweet taste, perfect. But it turns out they are interacting with our bodies through our gut microbes, and the microbes can't break them down easily. So it sort of creates a bit of a wave down there that leads to all these abnormal chemicals being produced. Because you have to see your gut microbiome really as a whole series of mini pharmacies that are constantly producing chemicals for our body, and when they're fed. And so they can't tell the difference between food chemicals and artificial chemicals or drugs. So they'll take whatever comes down and try and convert it into something useful. But they get stuck when they have these artificial sweeteners. And studies have shown that you can get So they cause abnormalities when you treat them in mice, and there's some limited data also saying the same thing happens in humans. So, but it might be quite specific, so it might be personalized. The other, so that's artificial sweeteners, which have this effect that, you know, really we've, the industry's been trying to stop us studying it, and that's why there's only a few studies, most of them coming from Israel, which, you know, you think, for something that's so common, why is it that, you know, across the world we know so little about these things? And, you know, why are we told they're, you know, they really are healthy when they're not, they've not been properly tested? The other thing in ultra-processed foods, apart from sweeteners, is things called emulsifiers. These are like the glues or gums that stick food together. Because ultra-processed food is made from extracts of other foods, it's not made from the whole food originally, they have to glue these powders and these liquids together to make it look like solid food again. And these emulsifiers, some of them occur in nature, but not in these quantities, and others are artificially made. So these things like carrageenans and lecithins. And when you put these again into mouse models and humans, you find that a proportion of people react quite badly against them and cause abnormalities in the gut microbiome, probably because they make your microbes stick to each other. They can't break them down properly, and it messes up their function. So I think that's just two of the ways we know about they affect the gut microbiome. And we really haven't tested everything to any great extent. But that, to me, that's enough to say we should have a real red flag about emulsifiers and artificial sweeteners in foods. And of course, they also contain various preservatives, and any major dose of preservatives that gets to the gut microbes is going to have an antibacterial effect, which could be negative.
And so the effect then of some of these chemicals that are in highly processed foods, that of course is coming on top of you know, things like too much fat or too much sugar or salt and that kind of thing that we see in those kinds of foods. I was intrigued too that things like orange juice fall into the processed food category, and it seems like an absolute no-no.
Yes, I think orange juice really is actually a really unhealthy food that people should be warned about, and many countries still have it on their list of, you know, your five a day that, you know, particularly parents should be giving their kids. And it's just giving them pure sugar the way it's produced. And it's, yeah, most of the orange juice we drink is 2 years old. It's been kept in vats around the world, shipped in finally. And then, you know, they top it up with these flavor packets that give it, it's tasteless in the vats, and they just give it that orange flavor back. So it is highly processed by most definitions. So a lot of this stuff, you know, people are unaware of, and the subtle differences between, you know, items. So there are some potato crisps, for example, that, you know, in their pure form, their sort of artisan form, are really just, you know, shaved potatoes with the skins on, and they're fried in oil, which are only, I'd say, minimally processed. They have a bit of salt on it. And then there's others, which, you know, we know several, but the most classic example is Pringles, which, you know, majority of it is not even made with potatoes. It's a combination of rice and various soy and various, you know, glue stuck together, paste, high pressure, and all sorts of chemicals added to make us make them super tasty, make it difficult for us just to have one. And, you know, we're really unaware of all of the sort of 10 or 20 ingredients there are in that, made by these brilliant scientists to make us overeat. And I think this is the other the other reason that ultra-processed foods are so damaging is that it's now been proven that if you eat an identical meal, one ultra-processed, one whole food made at home in your own kitchen, you will probably overeat by about, you know, over 10, 15%. That's about 300 calories in that day. Because of just the composition of how that food is presented to your body. So they've done such a good job, these food scientists, that they can make it not only tasty, but it sort of deflects your hunger and satiety signals so that you don't feel full. And this research I'm referring to was done in a very careful lab, big lab in the US, by a US government scientist who didn't need a grant, otherwise he probably wouldn't have got it because of the lobbying, and was able to do this study in people who stayed for 2 weeks, basically in their institution, who were monitored, either given identical calorie foods, one made from scratch and the others made highly processed, and the two were sort of equally liked by the participants, but unknown to them, they were overeating and gain weight in that time. So that's what's happening to all of us who have too much ultra-processed foods in our diet. And I think we don't totally understand the mechanisms, but it's a combination of how it affects the gut microbes and how it affects our brain and our sensory signaling. And, you know, to me, it is the number one problem in our food system that we're just not addressing because the economics is stacked against us. And it's quite similar to where we were, you know, perhaps in the 1980s with cigarettes, when we knew they were sort of not very good for us, but we thought there were safe ways of doing it. And so we could promote things like low tar cigarettes or low nicotine, or these special filters that would make it better. And this idea of ultra-processed food that has all these low-fat labels and these low sugar, no sugar added and high protein, you know, it's all fooling us. And that's what I really object to. We're not going to cut out these foods. Everyone eats them at some time in the year. But we should know what we're eating, and we shouldn't be conned as individuals. I think we have a right to know what is good and bad for us and what's going to make us overeat.
It is quite an overwhelming space trying to work out what what a good thing is to eat, in inverted commas, because, you know, there have been times where fat has been bad or fat has been good, and likewise with carbs, likewise, you know, calories in, calories out. Is it really as simple as that? It's a pretty tricky area for people to navigate, even if people are, you know, interested in nutrition and want to do the right thing.
Well, absolutely. And if it was straightforward, we'd have sorted this out, and we wouldn't be obese with diabetes, in sort of one in three people with obese children. So I think what's happened, though, is, you know, and this is the reason I write these books, is that things have happened so rapidly. The science has progressed from a really low level to a really high level in a short space of time. And public opinion, public guidelines, medical advice, government websites, all this stuff hasn't kept up the pace with what's happening in the science of nutrition. And that's really why, I write these books, so the people that read them are really up to speed on all these incredible changes. And 10 years ago, we didn't know about the gut microbiome. We had no idea it interacted with everything we ate and send these signals across our body, had no idea of its power on the immune system and our daily lives. We had no idea, you know, of how these foods interacted with this new organ in our bodies. And we didn't know I think we may have known, but we're trying to avoid thinking about how complicated food was. And we've got new technology that breaks down food in things called mass spectrophotometry that tells you that, you know, food is not just these three components of fats, proteins, sugars. It's 30,000 different chemicals that all have these interacting effects. And so I think we've just suddenly, you know, it's like we've discovered a new age of science, that we understand that this old idea of reductionism, it's just about those three characteristics of food plus calories, and that, you know, the body is like a tube or a furnace that you just feed in energy one end and you expend it the other, and that's all there is to it. And that we now know that is reductionist nonsense, and it is complex. So I think people have got to realize that, you know, dumbing it down is not the answer to this. It is people actually going back and understanding food and quality food and whole food and the differences, you know, not just allowing someone else to dominate what you eat, and you're eating stuff you haven't got a clue what it is because of these policies. But, you know, we haven't even discussed things like personalization, but, you know, that has blown apart this idea that, you know, one size fits all diets work. You know, we've known for 20 years that calorie counting doesn't work, but we still have a massive, you know, multi-billion dollar industry that's promoting it. Although, you know, it probably fails for, you know, over 95% of people. And yet, you know, and the science is now caught up with that. No serious obesity expert believes in calorie counting, and yet that industry persists. So there's many things that we've, you know, baggage we've had for the last 40 years that we're carrying around, that we were taught by our parents or wherever. It turns out to be nonsense. So we've got to just, you know, wipe the slate clean. But I think the way to do that is to learn about food and our bodies much more, and it should be taught to all children, and everybody should realize that, because people forget, but the single most important thing you can do for your health is your food choices. And the single most important thing you can do for the planet is also your food choice.
A quick word about the personalization that you just touched on there, because you have founded a company that offers home kits, home testing. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yes, so just over 5 years ago, I founded a company called Zoe, which is based in the UK and the US, with a couple of internet entrepreneurs. And we got a lot of money to do basic research for 3 years, whereby we did the world's largest nutrition intervention studies called PREDICT, where thousands of people ate the same foods and we saw their response to it with glucose monitors, fat monitors, and measuring the gut microbes. And it turns out that when we're given identical muffins or milkshakes, we have about a tenfold difference in our response to that food. So you and I would respond very differently by chance just to the same food, although we'd be instructed, you know, that calorie should have exactly the same effect. And these sugar peaks and these fat peaks have very different, have effects on your body with inflammation. They can make you overeat, make you tired, give you diabetes or heart disease long term. So we've discovered this huge personalization. Even identical twins in our study had different responses to food. So it's that individualization, which we've now commercialized in a home kit from those experiments. We just reduced it to the simple basics. And now we have 50,000 people in the US and the UK that have done these tests and are finding that once we've done these tests, we give them prediction about how they respond to any food. And they have an app which gives them scores for all their foods, so they can naturally pick foods that are either high in fats or high in carbs, depending on what their responses are. And that they're finding massively improves their energy levels, improves things like sleep and mood, and reduces hunger. And most of them are also able to lose weight. So This is without talking once about calories, not restricting anything, just sort of a way of educating people about how a food affects your own body rather than someone else's.
For people who aren't able to go to those kind of lengths and get that level of personalization, what would some general principles be that you would put forward for healthy eating that, you know, that anyone could take up?
Well, I think everyone can benefit if they follow a diet that improves the health of their gut microbes. Because, as I said, this is like an organ in the body that you really want to train up, like having a healthy heart or brain. And so you've got to treat it like a rich garden or a jungle and make sure that as many different species are there that can pump out these fantastic chemicals that help your immune system. So the way to do that is try and increase the number of different plants you have every week. So we found the sweet spot is if you can get us, you know, up to 30 plants a week, that's where your optimum gut health is. And people might say, oh, I can't have 30 types of kale. That's horrible. I'll never do this. But nuts and seeds are all individual plants. There's a difference between a purple carrot and an orange one. People forget that herbs and spices are also plants, and people forget the sum of our foods, which we've told in the past were unhealthy but turn out to be healthy for us. Like coffee is a plant and is a source of energy for your gut microbes as well as fiber. So I think it's taking a different sort of view. Forget your, five a day or whatever it is. Focusing on 30 a week is getting you most of the way there. You want to pick plants that cover the rainbow, so you've got lots of different colors and hues, because that means they've got these defense chemicals in them, polyphenols. So that means even a glass of red wine is actually good for your gut microbes. Probably one is about the optimum. More than that, it gets a bit unclear. And you want fermented foods every day. So that's not just yogurt and cheese, if it's high quality cheese, not the processed kind. But then you've got kefirs, fermented milks, you've got fermented tea, kombucha. And of course, what's really fantastic is kimchi or sauerkraut, miso, some of these Japanese foods as well. So try to change your diet so you've got a bit, you can stimulate your gut that way. And then finally, trying to fast more in the, so you're resting your gut overnight. And we think the sweet spot for this resting period is probably about 14 hours. But if you can give yourself over 12 hours where you're not having anything except black tea, black coffee or water, then that is really good for your gut health, which will be good for you. So if you do that and you reduce your snacking periods as well, reduce ultra processed foods, everyone can do that and everyone will get healthier.
The 30 plants that you talk about, initially that feels like a lot. And, I guess a lot of people might think, crikey, that feels like it might be quite complex. That feels like it possibly might be quite expensive. One thing we've not spoken about is meat and fish. What are your thoughts on either of those being included in diets, and where should people perhaps be taking care? What kind of pitfalls should people be looking for?
Well, the meat and fish argument, small amounts of good quality meat or small amounts of good quality fish are not bad for you. But the more you have on your plate, the less plants you get. So I think the reason that they've come out, certainly meat has come out adversely in epidemiology studies, is it means people are generally meat eaters are not eating the same diversity of plants that non-meaters are. So I think we should be reducing both meat and fish intakes, and not only for our health, but also it's the most important thing we can do for the planet. So reducing beef, lamb and dairy is the biggest single thing any individual can do on the planet at the moment for to reduce climate change. And that's because of land use. And there's plenty of other ways to get proteins. The fish is overrated, in my view, as a health food. Plenty of mussels and oysters and clams are very good and sustainable. Other fish is not sustainable at these current levels or with fish farms. So I've changed my mind on some of these things in the last, just in writing the book. I think your point about cheapness and price is important. It does sound a bit elitist, but to be honest, you can buy big packs of mixed seeds and nuts, which are not expensive and very good sources of protein. You've got many vegetables and plants which come in cans. You can buy, I know, 10 different types of bean in cans, which are very cheap in most countries. Frozen vegetables, peas, runner beans, again, broccoli. These things are fine nutrition-wise if frozen. So you don't have to sort of get high-end foods for it to be nutritious and healthy for your gut. And, you know, herbs and spices, again, generally, they spice mix is a fairly cheap way to add things. So it's not necessarily about paying for the most artisan stuff. And the fermented foods, many you can make them yourself very cheaply just by getting starter grains and things. Cost virtually nothing if you do it yourself, or you know, you can choose to buy more expensive ones in shops. So I think in these times, yes, we do have to be very conscious about cost, but I think everything I've suggested is possible on a budget as well as if you don't have that.
Just finally, you mentioned you know, the 1980s and smoking. I suppose drawing a parallel, what is the difference that people can see if they get themselves onto the right diet, or at least a better diet? What's the efficacy?
Well, immediately, that if you go from ultra processed foods to whole foods and you try and avoid these sugar spikes and fat spikes, we've seen from our 50,000 people who have done this that they'll instantly see an improvement in energy levels. They won't have these sugar dips, which give them after a sugary, you know, a breakfast cereal, 3 hours later, a dip in energy and increase in hunger. They won't see that. And hunger levels will go down. You have less cravings. You'll be less desire for snacks outside your meal times. And yeah, your gut health will improve. You'll also see, you know, bowel movements become more regular. You'll have less bloating and irritation. So lots of short-term things you will notice. And longer term, yeah, you will improve your mood. There's lots of evidence that these diets improve anxiety and depression, at least as well as antidepressants. And you know, you'll have less of these common chronic diseases. And I think, you know, and even women going through the menopause, we've got data now showing how that improves their menopausal symptoms. So many ways people can do this. So I advise everyone to, you know, make a New Year's resolution or do it now, and just try for a month eating for your gut and see what happens.